From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Bill Clinton was and is a famously polarizing figure, a president bitterly reviled and deeply adored. Now, a breakthrough new account of the man and his White House lays bare the survivalist instincts that made him tick and the mark his personality and politics left on the country. Tonight on Point, Bill Clinton, without tears of rage or adoration. But first, we begin tonight in Washington, where a bipartisan group of House lawmakers today introduced a measure that would require President Bush to announce a plan this year to start withdrawing U.S. troops from Iraq no later than October 2006. Two Republicans and two Democrats sponsored the resolution. One of them is Republican Congressman Walter Jones of North Carolina, who voted for authorizing the war, but recently began pushing for an exit plan.
As you see, the four of us here today represent the whole political spectrum, from a liberal to a conservative and a moderate to a libertarian. Though each of my friends here today brings a different perspective to the table, we all have reached the same conclusion on this importance of this resolution. What we all agree on is that it is time for a public discussion of our goals and the future of our military involvement in Iraq. This resolution does no more than call on the president to set a plan and a date to begin reducing the number of troops we have in Iraq.
Republican Congressman Walter Jones of North Carolina speaking there today. John Hendren covers the Pentagon for the Los Angeles Times. He joins me now from Washington. John, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
We saw the very quick pushback from White House spokesman Scott McClellan saying it would send absolutely the wrong message to send any kind of artificial timetable. So is this just whistling in the wind, or is there a real movement afoot that you can feel to put some kind of end date on this involvement?
It's a little bit of both. On the one hand, I think it's very unlikely that any such action would happen, that the administration would say we're getting out by this date or we're going to start to draw down by this date. But what's interesting here is that you've got a little bit of support behind the anti-war movement that you didn't have before. You've got Democrats who were reluctant to speak out early in the war, and you've got some moderate Republicans talking about how they believe that we should pull out or at least begin to reduce the number of troops. And that's a big step. So it suggests a kind of change in Congress, even if this particular motion isn't going to make any difference.
And how do you follow the thinking of a congressman like Walter Jones? I mean, this guy's no softy. This was the guy who proposed changing the name. You know, we call French fries freedom fries instead of French fries. So he was very gung-ho, and now he's standing up even right in the teeth of the White House, very explicit rejection, saying, no, we've got to talk about this.
And he's been given the power to do that, both by opinion polls that show members of Congress that the public is increasingly critical of the conduct of the war, and by the relatively high death tolls from an insurgency that has launched increasingly spectacular car bomb and other attacks that have really captured the international imagination. It's a time when things have been ripe for change. You had the election in November here in the United States, which occurred just as there was an invasion of Fallujah. Mm-hmm. The American troops were trying to get rid of an insurgent stronghold, and then at the end of January, you had the Iraqis' own election, and that sort of imbued Americans with a sense of hope and progress in Iraq. Mm. This is different. Things have been going badly, and you're starting to see that public opinion is reverberated enough that it's reached Congress, and when Congress begins to act, it's sort of a lagging indicator that things are not going well.
John, you're at the Pentagon. Now, the White House says that any kind of deadline, artificial timetable, Scott McClellan's words today, would send the wrong message to the Iraqi people, to the terrorists, to the U.S. troops. How do Pentagon brass see it?
I would say that, by and large, they agree with that assessment, that they don't believe that you can turn over control or that you can tell the insurgents we're going to leave by such a date. However, they leave a lot of leeway. You certainly could draw down troops if you had the Iraqi troops well enough trained to take over. That's one of the problems. Those Iraqi troops really have been slow in the training process, the police in particular. So I would say the Army brass is by and large supportive of the sentiment that you can't just set a date, but at the same time, they also are frustrated with the progress of this war. I've talked to a number of generals who have expressed frustration with how slowly things are going and how slowly we're transferring authority to the Iraqis themselves.
Do they want an exit plan? At some level, are they happy for the pressure of Congress on the White House, on the civilian leadership, to think about getting out?
I think they are. I think they're particularly, a number of them anyway, that I've spoken with, like the idea that the administration is now under pressure to come up with a plan to get them out. The Army has been so thinly stretched through this that a number of senior Army officers are concerned about how long they're going to be occupied there in Iraq.
John, thanks for the insight tonight. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
John Hendren covers the Pentagon for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke with us from Washington. Do you know who I am? Bill Clinton once asked a tormenting Newt Gingrich. I'm the big rubber clown doll you had as a kid, and every time you hit it, it bounces back. That's me. The harder you hit me, the faster I come back up. We thought we knew everything about this infamously exposed president. A new biography from Washington Post Clinton White House correspondent John Harris proves we did not. Harris covered Clinton for 6 years in the White House. Now he's out with an account being hailed as the most objective and insightful yet on a singular president and his unique and perhaps still unfolding legacy. Tonight on Point, Bill Clinton reconsidered. You can join the conversation. Are you ready to weigh this president one more time? Have absence or George W. made the heart grow fonder or not? And did Bill Clinton's politics leave with him? Will Hillary bring them back to the White House? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from St. Paul, Minnesota, is John Harris. He's a veteran political reporter for The Washington Post. He covered the Clinton presidency from 1995 to its end in 2001. His much-celebrated new book is entitled The Survivor, Bill Clinton in the White House. John Harris, great to have you with us tonight. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack. Good to have you on board.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Mr. Harris.
John Harris, here you were 6 years right next to the man. Before you tell us about your conclusions, sitting back to write a biography of those White House years, what was it like covering Bill Clinton?
Well, it was certainly in retrospect great fun. At the time, it was often frustrating. Sometimes people look back at the Clinton White House, which I think it was more transparent than the Bush White House, as some kind of golden age. But it wasn't that. Every White House has its frustrations to cover. You see only the fragments of truth, fragments of reality as to what's really happening. That's one reason the assignment of going back and reconstructing the critical events of these years appealed to me. What could I learn now that wasn't possible at the time?
It's a great account and really reads wonderfully, and lots of anecdotes. We'll dig into them here that we have not heard before. But what are you finding as you get out there on the hustings, John? I really do think there was a time when almost nobody wanted to hear about Bill Clinton, even people who had supported him. Do they now? Is there an appetite to go back and look at this president, this man, just 4 or 5 years after he left office?
Yes, I think there is. I'm finding that there is. As your question suggested, part of this on the Democratic side is the experience of George W. Bush and, frankly, John Kerry. Both Al Gore and John Kerry had shown that what Clinton did, for all the frustrations of Clinton's political style, what he did was no mean feat. Getting elected twice in a row hasn't been possible for Democrats to do again. He and Bush are so different in terms of the leadership models they represent, in terms of what they stand for, in terms of America's role in the world, that I think that has put, on the Democratic side, Clinton in a different light, in a new light, and led to a revival. On the Republican side, I sense the animus that he provoked at the time has diminished a little bit, and there is more of an appreciation of Bill Clinton as a larger-than-life personality, as an American original, as I say in my title, a survivor. Now, I have no doubt that much of that animus is now going to transfer to Hillary Clinton. In fact, already has. But I think there is a sense of, okay, what was this guy all about? Let's take him on his own terms.
Jack Beatty, How about you? Are you ready to turn back and gaze upon Bill Clinton today, or is he still the rubber clown he described himself as to Newt Gingrich there, bouncing annoyingly up in the face? How do you think about him these days?
Well, I am through John Harris's eyes. This book, I think, will change interpretations of the Clinton presidency. People said, when he was in office, I said, well, let's separate the personal from the political. Did bad things, but he was a successful president. Politically, he was okay. This book shows again and again in domestic matters and in foreign affairs, and especially in the fight against Osama bin Laden, the personal overcame the political. Bill Clinton's personal troubles, which is to say his predatory sexual behavior toward women, reached right into public policy in the healthcare debate and into foreign policy again and again. And I just don't think you can make that separation between the personal and the political with Bill Clinton after this interpretation.
John Harris, it's your interpretation. Are you on board with that? Are they inseparable?
Well, it is funny because this book, just like Bill Clinton himself, is to some degree a Rorschach test. Some people have come away thinking that it's a fairly positive portrait of Bill Clinton. And other people have reached the conclusion that Jack did, which is that, look, these personal flaws had huge public consequences. I believe both. You know, forever with Bill Clinton, it's a mixed verdict.
John, if you'll stand by, we're going to take a short break here. We'll come back and dive right into what you found. It's really a fascinating tale. John Harris is with us. His new book is The Survivor, Bill Clinton in the White House. Are you ready to weigh this man, this president, one more time? Have you come to terms with Bill Clinton, with what he meant for the country, for you? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are taking one more long look at Bill Clinton tonight and the mark his personality and politics left on the country. Our guest tonight is John Harris, national politics editor for The Washington Post. He is author of the new biography, The Survivor, Bill Clinton in the White House, and it's really a terrific piece of work. I really thought, I have to say, others have said it, John, they weren't ready to read, but I dug in, and in fact, there was a lot new here. It really caught my eye. Listeners, you can join us tonight. Bill Clinton was a survivor, says John Harris. What else was he? And has George W. Bush changed your mind about Bill Clinton? In what direction? And maybe this, did Clinton's third-way politics leave with him? Will they last? Were they a flash in the pan? Will Hillary bring them back to the White House? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And I'm looking, laughing here on your dust jacket. As you were saying, John, people can interpret this book many different ways. Here we've got Britt Hume with Fox News saying, John Harris reaches a generally favorable verdict on Bill Clinton, but there is no lack of evidence that could lead to a different conclusion. One of those left-handed compliments, but still a compliment.
Sure, I'll take it.
Yeah, you'll take it. It's on the dust jacket. John, begin to take us in here to some of what we don't know, the nuggets, the anecdotes you've dug up. And a good place to start may be right back early in the Clinton administration's first administration around the health revamp that he tried to work on with Hillary. It gets pretty messy in a hurry. I'm here just on, I don't know, page, what is it, Jack? 118?
Yeah.
118. I wish you'd take us in, Johnny, and give us a sort of paint the picture of how weird it got.
Well, it did get strange, and I think this is an example of why I hope people will read this as history, but also see that it's got some contemporary vitality, because healthcare, obviously now 11, almost 12 years in the past, but Democrats live with the consequences of that defeat to this day. More than any issue, it was what powered Newt Gingrich's Republican Revolution in 1994. They've never let Gingrich is gone, but the Republican majority in the House has been secure for more than a decade. Hillary Clinton, now often talked about as perhaps the salvation for the Democrats, and she may well be. But more than any other person currently in office, she was the author of that misjudgment. And it's fascinating to me as an illustration in the differences that their two minds work, Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton's. Bill Clinton, all things being equal, wants to be an accommodator. He would gladly split the difference on almost any issue, take what he can get today, declare victory, and come back tomorrow if there's an opportunity to do so. Hillary Clinton, put in charge of that plan, she was determined that she present an intellectually coherent whole plan. And under her conception of health care reform, it only worked if they could get 100% of Americans with health insurance, laudable goal. Bill Clinton made it an absolute. He had promised to the Congress, look, if you send me a bill with less than 100% coverage, I'll veto it. Mm. Come 1994, he's desperate to get out. It's obvious this thing is becoming a millstone.
Right.
Clinton, with every fiber of his being, wants to somehow, he sees this debacle coming, he wants to somehow avert it. Hillary Clinton is the obstacle. One day, Bill Clinton is actually up in Boston speaking to the national governors.
Yes.
And you know, the thing about Bill Clinton, sometimes people called him Slick Willie, but actually he was the most transparent of politicians. If something was on his mind, inevitably it would be on his lips. He gets up there, goes off message, says, you know what, I said 100%, but if we could get to 90, 95, you know, that might be pretty
somewhere
good.
Somewhere in the ballpark, that'd be all right.
Yeah.
And with that, he backed away from Hillary's absolutism, and she went ballistic.
Oh, she was furious. She found out about it on the wire. Somebody who was in the room with her told me about this. She picks up the phone in the White House, says, get me the president right away. When he comes on the line, it's a blue streak. Hillary Clinton can be a tough woman with pretty salty vocabulary when she's angry. She says, what are you doing up there?
That's the cleaned-up version.
Here.
What the F are you doing up there?
There's a beep. There's a beep in there, Tom. What are you doing up there? You get back here right away. Clinton comes back sheepishly, and the next day he retracts it.
Still committed to universal coverage, 100%. Hillary's put him back on the straight and narrow. Jack, what did you make of
that?
But
it's a debacle.
Yeah, well, yeah, it was a debacle. Jack, how did you read it?
Well, you know, there are two sides to that. As John points out, Senator Chafee and Senator Dole at the beginning of the administration were talking about a plan that would have insured a lot of Americans, 90-some-odd percent. But by the time the summer of 1994, the Republican strategy had changed. Their strategy became just say no. Bill Kristol wrote one of the most cynical memos, I think, in recent American political history.
Editor of the Weekly Standard, very influential neocon.
That's right. He said to the Republicans, look, we have to stop Clinton's health care program, not because it won't work, but because it might well work. And if it worked, it would create a generation of loyalist Democratic voters just as Social Security did. We can't have anything to do with this because it might give Americans health care. Think of that.
Bill Kristol's going to be with us in a couple of weeks. We'll have to ask him about that. But John Harris, you acknowledged throughout that he was up against ferocious opposition here, yet in that quote that you got that he gave Newt Gingrich, in a way, Bill Clinton was made for ferocious opposition.
Well, it is the great paradox. We think of Bill Clinton as one of the greatest, most natural politicians of his generation. That's true. But the point that the book, I think, underscores is that he was at his best as a defensive politician. That is when he was defining himself in contrast to others, whether that was Newt Gingrich or Ken Starr or just simply the circumstances. When he was in a position to create his own circumstances, to advance his own agenda when the Democrats still had power, he wasn't a terribly skilled politician. Those years were marked by some policy achievements, but by repeated political miscalculations.
And you say the fact that he was better on defense than offense is part of what cuts him off from ultimately being really a great president.
To my mind, it's not possible for a presidency to be defined by the ethic of survival, the imperative of survival, to practice a defensive politics and to reach in, to make it to that highest tier of presidencies, which, of course, put Bill Clinton in a romantic mood, desperately wanted to be. Since he was a boy, he was dreaming of being one of these larger-than-life great progressive presidents along the lines of FDR.
And there's this recounted incident here where he's talking with Dick Morris, and we should talk about that, but, of course, the super but also very controversial political consultant in a routine phone call, Dick Morris talking about where he might end up ranking, saying that there were only 18 presidents out of the 40 before Clinton who had truly made history. Only five, Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, Wilson, FDR, qualified as first tier. And then just kind of casually telling Bill Clinton that he thought that he, as president, was probably borderline third tier. Wow, that's not much of a compliment. Yeah.
Right. Well, probably all presidents have, to some degree, these kind of flights of fancies. I don't know that there's anyone who's ever approached it quite so expressly as a campaign. Morris's point was, look, it's hard to be first tier without a great sort of titanic clash, and history hasn't presented you with that. Of course, one irony is that, in fact, such a clash was building, I think, in the conflict with Islamic terrorism. Clinton perceived that, but wasn't able to convey his sense of urgency to the rest of the country.
You write very interestingly about that. We should look at his relationship with Louis Freeh, but I want to begin to bring our callers in. Chantel is calling from Anchorage, Alaska. Hi, Chantel. You're on the air.
Oh, thanks. I guess my comment would be Bill Clinton seemed to me to be an intellectual, and he could portray a kind of vision of America that was at least aware of what was going on outside of America and how that impacted us. I did vote for Clinton in 96 and 92. I was 15, so I didn't vote for him.
Yeah.
But I guess George W. Bush doesn't seem to care, doesn't portray caring about outside of what's going on in the United States, or in my opinion, in the South, or the moral values debate. And I think Bill Clinton just seemed to me to be a more intellectual presence in the forum, the world stage.
Chantel, has George W. changed your mind about Bill Clinton? Has he made you look back on the Clinton years in a different way?
In the second Bill Clinton second term, I was not so much opposed. And in 2000, I was not a supporter. He seemed to be the best option for me at that time, other than Bob Dole. But by 2000, I voted for Ralph Nader. So I had moved left. Bill Clinton was too right for me. He wasn't a liberal enough for me, in my taste. So
you moved right on by him. Chantel, thanks very much for your call there. What about the third way politics that he brought, John Harris? How do you judge it? A lasting mark, a lasting style of politics, or kind of a Bill Clinton creation? As you write that he liked to work in the seams, between clashing views. So did he make something lasting there or not?
To my mind, his great policy achievements, particularly on the domestic front, were when he could challenge his own party's instincts and he could modernize his party and oriented toward the challenges of a changing world. Democrats don't gravitate temperamentally to deficit reduction, but Clinton believed that it was the important thing to do, that it was critical to economic growth. Obviously, Democrats have misgivings about welfare reform. He pushed his party that direction and signed welfare reform. I think history has shown that on balance that was a good thing. Same with free trade. One of the consequences of the Lewinsky episode in 1998 is that project of his, updating his party toward a third way brand of progressivism, largely got frozen. Republicans were ready to evict him. As he said, Newt Gingrich told him in a meeting, "Mr. President, we're going to run you out of town." It turned out Gingrich was the one that left town prematurely or left office.
Mm-hmm.
But Clinton was dependent on every last Democratic vote. So at that time, he no longer had the leverage to continue that experiment.
Jack Beatty, I know you were struck by, John mentioned the Al-Qaeda and Bill Clinton's perception of Al-Qaeda, his apprehension of what might lie down that road, and how he was sort of frustrated in working on it in this interaction with Louis Freeh. What caught your eye there, Jack?
Well, it really, I think John justifies his harsh judgment that that President Clinton, failed in his duty to the country by not firing Louis Freeh. It would have been controversial because Freeh had his hands full of the Whitewater investigation.
Mm-hmm.
It would have looked like he was just getting rid of him because he was close on the trail of some scandal. But a great president and a man who, was going to live up to his oath would have said, "Look, I'll take that flak. This guy just is not on the same page with us on this war on terrorism."
John Harris, what did Bill Clinton see that Louis Freeh did not or wasn't willing to move on?
Bill Clinton nominated Louis Freeh. He was his appointment, but within a year or two, the relationship had soured. By the second term, it was completely dysfunctional. Louis Freeh thought Bill Clinton was a sleazy guy, untrustworthy. Bill Clinton thought Louis Freeh was incompetent and thought that he was busy playing a Washington game, trying to curry support from the Republicans in Congress rather than supporting the policies of the administration. Completely dysfunctional. I think some of the inquiries since 9/11 have indeed faulted Louis Freeh's administrative abilities. He was not able to infuse the FBI with the appropriate sort of bureaucratic urgency to fight terrorism. And One argument of the book is that for all we think of Bill Clinton as a hyperactive man, as somebody constantly full of whirling with ideas and speeches and always traveling, there is a certain passivity to his leadership style, and this is a great illustration of it. He desperately would have loved to fire Louis Freeh, didn't dare do it because it would have been a political uproar. To my mind, as Jack said, I think if he didn't have a relationship of confidence on such a critical position, he had no choice but to put somebody in there who could execute policies of the administration and take the political heat. Dick Clark, the anti-terrorism czar, came to that conclusion. And say what you will about Bush and Cheney, I guarantee from everything I've watched of these guys, they would never tolerate having somebody within their own administration whose loyalty and whose purposes were seen as at odds with the administration. They just wouldn't.
You say his was a presidency most effective when his advisors, Clinton's, offered him a clear direction. So some of that critique about a guy who just sits around eating too much pizza overnight and you know, in bull sessions, you say, yeah, he didn't.
Well, I think it's more sophisticated than, and I, my view is more nuanced. I do think history has given us a great experiment in contrasting leadership styles. President Bush, as near as I can tell, is somebody who gravitates toward black and white worldviews. He rather quickly arrives at an intuitive sense of right and wrong and pursues that without a lot of agonizing second guessing. The downside of that, lots of people believe, is that he can take flight from reality in his own certitudes. Clinton had a mind saw infinite shades of gray. The upside of that is he sees a complex world in all its complexity.
Yes.
He can understand nuance, but it can be paralyzing. And the advisors that had the greatest success, and frankly the people that Clinton looked to, were ones that helped bring him to closure, helped give him clarity. Hillary Clinton is one, although her judgment wasn't always good. She has a mind that actually is more like George Bush's, full of emphatic certitudes. Al Gore played that role on certain policy questions for Bill Clinton. Dick Morris, the political consultant, supremely played that. That's what his greatest contribution to Clinton was, to give him confidence at a time when his confidence was shattered, to give him that sense of black and white certitude that, look, we've got a plan to revive you politically. It will work.
Take that great intellect and put some spine under it and let it go. Phil is calling from Queens, New York. Hi, Phil. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you? Good show. Listen, Bill Clinton and Hillary lack dignity and they lack integrity. You know, from Travelgate on, mishandling gays in the military, Waco incinerating children, they mismanaged the FBI, they mismanaged ATF. They cut back at the SEC that allowed WorldCom and Enron and things like that to continue. They mismanaged Somalia, his lack of military experience. We pulled out of Somalia. Immediately.
Yep.
He failed to use the CIA and NSA to stop Osama and Al-Qaeda in the 90s when they should have been stopped. You know, forget about the sexual predator stuff. Forget about the campaign finance fundraising illegalities. He didn't respond. The President of the United States did not respond to a million dead black Rwandans. And he's supposed to be the great friend of the black people in America. That's disgraceful.
There is a laundry list. Let us pick it up, Phil. Thanks for your call, John Harris. You see that line of critique. Failure, 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 failure.
Sure, although it's odd in that caller that it's sort of coming from the right and the left simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
The criticism about Rwanda, I think, is a valid one. Certainly Bill Clinton has said that it's one of his greatest regret as president, but there was certainly no support whatsoever from the right for taking intervention in Rwanda. Look, what I hope that people can read in the book is somebody like this caller who sees Bill Clinton's flaws as so manifestly obvious has to wonder, well, how did he persist in office given all these flaws that are so obvious to him and, in fact, leave with an approval rating on his job performance up in high 60s, 70%? And I hope that I can provide an answer to that. But on the flip side, people who really saw Bill Clinton as so filled with historic potential can get an answer to that question of, well, why was he forever in these situations where he was fighting back from from crisis, and usually quite often self-imposed crisis.
You write about the blurring of function and dysfunction in the Clinton style. We'll come back and hear more about that. John Harris is with us. He's with the Washington Post. His new book is The Survivor, Bill Clinton in the White House. You can join the conversation tonight. Why did Bill Clinton drive people so crazy? Why did he make others swoon? And on balance, was he good for the country? Do you miss him now or no? 1-800-423-8255 is the number. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're taking one more long look at Bill Clinton tonight and the mark his personality and politics left on the country. John Harris is with us, reporter for The Washington Post, author of the new book, The Survivor, Bill Clinton in the White House. And it's a great one. Lots of new detail in here and a real even-handed take on a very polarizing president. You can join us tonight. Have you come to terms with Bill Clinton and what he meant for the country, for you? What would Bill Clinton have done after 9/11? What's your favorite Bill Clinton story? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Al Gore, John, take us into that relationship. You described this amazing meeting where they hadn't talked in about 18 months. Al Gore had just lost the election. He came in and pounded on the desk and essentially said, Bill, you lost the election for me.
That's right. This was in within a couple of days of the Supreme Court decision, which sent Florida into George Bush's column and, of course, gave him the election. And this once very productive political and policy relationship had become completely ruptured over the course of 1999 and 2000. And Gore had lost the presidency. He felt it was within his reach, but Clinton was to blame. And so 2 years of accumulated grievances got laid out in this incredible Oval Office meeting with just the two of them, but I was able to reconstruct it with conversations with close advisors to both men. Clinton himself was furious after this, at least initially, because he had, to put it mildly, the complete opposite view of why Gore lost.
What did he say? What did he think? What was his response ultimately to Al Gore?
His response was that Gore lost the election, and he said this to him very bluntly, by not running on the record. He felt that that Gore was wonderfully positioned to run on achievements that were in large measure his, because the two of them had worked together closely at a policy and political level for 6 of the 8 years of the presidency. One thing I didn't realize until reporting the book was at the personal level, the two men were never especially close. It's clear there were, on both sides, a buildup of resentments and minor grievances at the personal level, right back from the beginning of the relationship. Mm.
Yet they sat at the table and broke bread every week for years there. But ultimately, that meltdown when Al Gore moved away. But he felt he had to move away from this tarnished president who had the scandal of Monica Lewinsky around his neck. You write about Bill Clinton always loading his plate a little higher at life's buffet. Was Monica the ultimate or the lowest, call it what you will, expression of that?
I think it was. I think one reason Bill Clinton's a survivor is that he's defined by hunger. He has to stay in the game, and he's organized his entire life since childhood around politics. I think that hunger is one thing that makes him good. I do think in other contexts that hunger is the thing that leads him into disaster and the reason he's always fighting for survival. So that's why you see this cycle long predates the presidency of disaster and recovery.
You write about how Bill and Hillary from very early on knew that that potential big trap door of womanizing was out there to open up.
Yeah, certainly if you could time travel to Little Rock, Arkansas, 1977, Bill Clinton's in his late 20s, just elected, or maybe 30, just elected attorney general and stopped somebody at random and said, you know what, this young attorney general of yours is going to become governor and then become president, probably most people would never be surprised. And if you said, you know what, in another 20 years, there's going to be a scandal that will endanger his presidency, probably most of them could say, yep, I know what that's going to be about, too. This sense of vulnerability hovered over Clinton his entire life. The point about Lewinsky is that the anxiety among his staff about a potential sexual scandal long predated her. From the very first days, there was ongoing discussion, ongoing concern. How do we save Clinton from himself?
He'd write about this moment, of course, the famous press conference where he says, I did not have sexual relationship with that woman. And we had a little debate here about the way that you present this afternoon. You write that he stalked away from the lectern, shaking with anger, and told an aide that he had said that woman because he had blanked out on Monica Lewinsky's name. And the debate here was, did that really happen, or was he playing his own staff there, trying to kind of move away, give himself more room for deniability rhetorically?
Oh, I think I can shed some light on that, because remember, I was in the room at the time. It was only a small group, pool of reporters, but I happened to be in the press pool that day. Mm. And remember, it was that woman, and there was a pause, Ms. Lewinsky. And when he pivoted away, I did literally see him shaking with anger. The emotion of that moment, even though the words were false, the emotion of that moment was completely sincere. And I do believe that he did not mean the phrase that woman as a contemptuous note. It was just truly, he lost in the moment.
What's her name?
I feel pretty confident about that.
Tony's calling from Union City, New Jersey. Hi, Tony. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, good to have you.
I just have two quick things I want to say.
Yes, please.
The only thing that would defeat Clinton and Mr. Clinton is the true politician. He gets all the honors. He gets the cap with the gold tassel hanging, and he gets all of that as a politician. But the only thing that really almost defeated him was cholesterol. That's about it. And then as far as Mrs. Clinton is concerned, if I wanted to find out if she's got a shot coming up in the new election coming up in a few years, I'd go to the bookies in England, the odds makers in Las Vegas, and then my own opinion, and I'd add that all up, and I'd say, she ain't got a shot.
It doesn't look like she got it from where you stand, Tony. We got it. Thanks for that. John Harris, you're very interested in this relationship, ongoing, forward-moving, between Bill Clinton and Hillary and her presidential ambitions. That's where you say the legacy may not be a finished story yet. The Clinton's
way. Well, I don't
way.
Think it's a finished story. I think, as ever with Bill Clinton, he is dependent on his wife for his own salvation, because I think how he is viewed historically will depend in part on what happens to Hillary Clinton.
What do you mean by that exactly? Whether or not she wins or something else?
I think whether or not she wins. Look, if she doesn't run for president, I consider that highly unlikely, but if she doesn't, if she runs and doesn't win...
You say you think she's running for 2008.
Yeah, I'm virtually certain of it, and everybody I know, and I've been hanging around this gang for 10 years, everybody I know close to both of them is operating under that assumption.
Yep.
But if she were not to win, I think we would look back on the Clinton years as kind of a gaudy spectacle. In between the Cold War ended and this new war on terrorism begun, sandwiched by two Bushes. If Hillary Clinton were to win, I think we would have to confront the reality, and history would recognize this, that they represent not just the Clintons, but a certain approach to politics called Clintonism, and that it would straddle two decades or even three decades. They would define the generation. I think that Bill Clinton's historical legacy would be more substantial.
Jack Beatty, would you welcome back Clintonism?
Well, people thought for a while there it was going to save the Democratic Party. The trouble is that he didn't deliver. I mean, health care was the issue where he could have satisfied the old, the New Deal Democrats and then taken the party forward. I agree with what Phil said, that list of particulars. But, Tom O'Neill, Tip O'Neill, when he'd leave the house in the morning, he'd look in the mirror at the door, and his wife Millie would come up behind him and she'd say, Tom, you know you're right, don't you? And she meant you're right to go out and fight for school lunches, and you're right to go out to fight for people who need unemployment insurance and the rest. And boy, oh boy, did he know he was right. Mm. Clinton grew up in that same kind of world. He went to high school with people who need help, who need an active government, and he couldn't deliver for them. And his wife didn't deliver for them, and it was because of the conflict between them. So that's a tough thing, I think, to have. He didn't ground himself in his own experience of life. It was all about him.
But you know, all the way back, Jack, John Harris, you write here, you remind us of the speech that he gave to the DLC, the Democratic Leadership Council.
Right.
Too many people who used to vote for us, the very burdened middle class we're talking about, have not trusted us in national elections to defend our national interest abroad, put their values into our social policy at home, or to take their tax money and spend it with discipline. This is all the way back in, what, 90, 91?
Right. Well, I just disagree with Jack on that. Mm. I do think that Bill Clinton had, and it was a strength of his, a sense of the concrete human dimension of problems. He did not approach policy as an abstraction, and I do think that reflected the Arkansas experience. But he neglects another part of the Arkansas experience, which is any politician coming from that environment had to learn, on the progressive side, had to learn a defensiveness that gets woven into the politics. It is not a liberal country at the time Bill Clinton comes to power in the late 80s, early 90s. The only way progressives win, he believes, and I think the evidence is on his side, is by acknowledging that reality and saying people will support activist government, but only if it is presented in a certain way. And that is necessarily defensive, and it's unsatisfying to people who want a more affirmative, unapologetic, more traditionally liberal approach. But that is not who Bill Clinton is. The Arkansas experience defines him in both ways.
I want to get one more call here. Peter's calling from Southern Pines, North Carolina. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just think that other caller who is so negative on Clinton, he had to be born in a closet. Did he forget about Bosnia? We didn't lose one soldier in Bosnia. Had NATO on board.
Yeah.
Had the other countries with us. In 1998, they kicked the inspectors out of Iraq, and he bombed them. And I think one of the weapons inspectors said that he got rid of some of the weapons of mass destruction in that bombing.
Yeah.
Did they forget about what he did in...
pretty good economy in the 90s, too.
Yeah, the economy. What about... I think it was Newt Gingrich and Phil Graham deregulated Wall Street, and Bill Clinton tried to veto that, and they overrode his veto. And then after that, we had all the fraud in the financial sector and the line and Enron.
So don't forget the good side of Bill Clinton. And we hear it, Peter. Our time is short. John Harris, you end up coming down, I don't know by what margin you'd call it, but you end up coming down on what feels like a more favorable side on this president.
I do believe that for however much irresponsibility that Clinton sometimes exhibited in his personal life, and yes, that did have public consequences. In the end, on most policy questions, not all, but most, he made responsible choices that have held up decently over time.
Over time, and in a way, we talked earlier about Dick Morris saying, man, you're a third-tier president at best. What do you see him ending up? In history,
I see him as a great personality, an American original. Peter Jayle, the Dutch historian, said history is an argument without end. I think we're going to be arguing about Bill Clinton for decades. I do think the argument is going to center on his personality, on his larger-than-life character with all its assets and faults, perhaps more than the policy record, which was competent but didn't amount to large New Deal-style monuments that fundamentally changed the face of American life.
Jack Beattie, I've got to just say, Al Gore walked away from him, didn't win. It would have been, might have been quite a different American profile today if he had stuck a little closer to the Clinton line.
Gee, all he needed was 537 votes.
Right. Those have to be out there somewhere. John Harris, it really is a terrific piece of work, and we're grateful for your work on it and for your sharing it with us tonight. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I'm grateful for the chance to talk about it.
John Harris, Washington Post reporter and author of the new book, The Survivor, Bill Clinton in the White House. Jack Beattie, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. In a moment, Democrats dig deeper into the Downing Street memo. This is On Point. The so-called Downing Street memo was back in the news today. On Capitol Hill, a group of Democrats held a forum on the British government document that claims the Bush administration was determined in 2002 to invade Iraq and arranged intelligence to fit the plan. The memo made a big splash in Britain a month ago, but has only recently drawn mainstream media attention in the U.S. Now, 90-some members of Congress and 500,000 Americans have signed a letter to the president asking him to respond to questions raised by the memo. Today, White House spokesman Scott McClellan dismissed the memo and said no response is forthcoming. But Representative John Conyers, Democrat of Michigan, was still hammering away in today's forum. In this excerpt, he asks two of the panelists, former Ambassador Joseph Wilson and former CIA analyst Ray McGovern, if the memo contains anything we didn't know before.
The Downing Street minutes outline this administration's deliberate intention to manipulate intelligence in order to justify a predetermined policy of war against Iraq. Some in the media have suggested these revelations are nothing new. What do the Downing Street minutes tell us that we did not know before they were revealed? Ambassador?
Let me begin, if I may, Congressman, thank you. A year after the Downing Street memo appeared, I asked the question in my New York Times article, was the U.S. fixing the intelligence, essentially? It's very clear to me that in July 2002, at the very highest levels of the British government, they had concluded that that was the case, that war was inevitable and the facts were being fixed around the policy. Now, there have been a number of articles that suggest that nothing was new, that we knew all that at the time. Indeed, yesterday there was an opinion piece in the Washington Post that suggested all that. I would submit, sir, that I don't think that Jim Baker would have written his piece, which was written after July of 2002, nor would Brent Scowcroft have written his piece. Both were senior advisors to President George Herbert Walker Bush. I may not have written the piece that I wrote in October of that year had I believed that, in fact, the cards had already been dealt. General Anthony Zinni, who was the commander-in-chief of CENTCOM, which has that particular part of the world in its region, may well not have participated in the debate until December had he known. Indeed, he told me, and I've put it in my book, that he left the debate in December, 6 months after the Downing Street memos, because in his judgment at that time, the decisions had all been made.
You remind me that many members of Congress said if they had known this before we voted to give the president additional military authority in Iraq, he might not have gotten any votes, or certainly very few, had this knowledge been available to us then.
Of course, Paul Wolfowitz, then the Deputy Secretary of Defense, was quoted in Vanity Fair as having said, we settled on weapons of mass destruction because that was something that we could sell.
Right. Mr. McGovern.
Apropos your remark about congressmen and senators feeling misled, I would point out that even Senator Pat Roberts, head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, no liberal he, has admitted that had he known some of the things that came out since, he has strong doubts as to whether there would have been a vote for war.
Former CIA analyst Ray McGovern, former Ambassador Joseph Wilson, and Congressman John Conyers speaking at today's Washington Forum on the Downing Street memo. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.